For the first time, he caught a glimpse of what he meant to Tesh. The kid he'd allowed to share his fire under the wool. The wild animal he'd tamed with discarded bones had latched onto him more deeply than he'd believed.
"Now you went and did it, didn't you?"
Padera hobbled over with a bag slung on one shoulder.
"Broke that arm good."
She set the bag down and pulled out boards and cloth straps. As she did, a smile formed.
"Why is everyone so happy?" Wraith asked. "Have the elves left?"
The old woman shook her head.
"You didn't die."
Malcolm and Wraith exchanged looks.
"Doesn't seem cheerworthy,"
Wraith replied, as he struggled to put his back to the stone wall near the steps. Tesh laughed. The kid was giddy enough to be drunk. The moment the thought appeared, Wraith wanted beer.
"Dear Mara, a foaming cup would be marvelous."
Padera pointed toward the front gate, where worn, weary, and blood-covered men were still dragging themselves in.
"This is the first clash. The first time men have ever fought Frey. No one knew what would happen."
Tesh was nodding emphatically.
"Nephron himself. He was standing next to me on the parapet. He said, 'This will decide it all.' Even he didn't know."
"You did great,"
Padera said, as she felt his arm squeezing here and there.
"Walloped them good."
Padera pressed on the broken bone.
"Ah, there we are. Not bad. Not too bad at all."
She stretched his arm out and slipped a board underneath.
"You got the Miralith like you were supposed to, and proved men could fight. Nephron says they're scared now, or ought to be. You're heroes."
"All the Miralith are dead, then?"
Tesh shook his head.
"Not all. A lot, though. Crippled them, we think."
"Still have giants," Wraith said,
and he grunted as Padera used the boards to set his bone.
"You killed three!"
Tesh was bouncing on his haunches. Then he frowned. Wraith's eyes were watering, and he jerked a bit with the pain the old woman was inflicting on him, but still saw the kid's expression.
"What?" "Gilroy and Bergen were talking about how many you killed. How elves aren't used to death. They were saying that this might be it. That they will leave now. That the war will end."
"And you're disappointed because you didn't get to fight?"
Tesh shrugged.
I just worked so damn hard."
Padera wrapped the planks with a cord, tying it tight, and made a harumph in Tesh's direction.
"A man who builds a roof shouldn't complain when it doesn't rain. The gods might send a flood."
Around the courtyard, other men were being tended to. They lay on the grass, exhausted, or sat looking dazed. Some cried, some stared. A few laughed, but not in a good way. A handful continued to wander the yard, clutching their weapons, moving quickly as if they had some place to be, but only walked in circles with confused looks.
"Where's Whedon?" Wraith asked.
Tesh refused to look at him.
"The glancing blow that broke Wraith's arm," Padera said. "The farmer took square."
Wraith looked around again, but couldn't find the farmer.
"They're leaving the dead down by the front gate,"
Tesh explained. In addition to three sons, Whedon had a daughter named Thea. Wraith had spoken to her only once in Dal Ren. He remembered that she wore her hair braided, and she was rail thin and tall for her age. She had died in the giant's attack on Dal Ren a year ago. That's when Whedon stopped being a farmer and became a soldier.
I was just talking to him. How can the world change so fast?
Padera created a sling to hook around his neck. As she tied it up, Wraith spotted Roan standing nearby. She had her heavy smithing apron on, the leather stained and scorched. Her face hadn't fared much better. Her cheeks were smeared with soot. Arms across her stomach, she clutched her elbows and stared with worried eyes. She shook her head, then without a word, walked away. Wraith stared after her.
"She's worried about Gifford,"
Padera said.
"Gifford? Why? Where is he?"
"Only Mara knows, and I suspect even she might not be certain."
Wraith was confused.
"How far can a cripple go?"
Padera smiled.
"That, I think, is the question of the century."
Chapter 22 The Pile at Purdiff. I truly believe that hardship makes better people. Pain, assuming that it does not break us, provides the strength of knowing that such things can be endured and overcome. And I know of no one who suffered more than Gifford. The Book of Bryn. There was no one there, just a pile on a hill. Didn't take long for Gifford to figure out why. Cresting the mound, he spied the village of Purdiff below, the remains of 5 charred huts circling a well. He counted the people, too. Wasn't hard. Only 12. All dead. The bodies lay scattered, men, women, children, and 2 dogs. They lay twisted and splayed on the dirt, not a weapon visible. Gifford fell off Narrowspur's lathered back. No other way down. The ground was as hard as it looked, and he lay for a moment waiting for the pain to pass. The horse left him, and walked slowly, wearily away. She'd be thirsty after the long morning race. Maybe she could smell water. Climbing to his feet and filling his lungs, Gifford called out. He waited, looked for movement below, listened, then called out again. No one answered. The only sound was the harsh, dry wind that blew unabated, and the flap of vultures' wings as they landed and fluttered from one body to the next. The sun was high, and Gifford hoped minutes didn't count because he had no idea how to light the signal fire. They had sent him out with food, water, magic armor, and a magic sword, but nothing that could produce a flame. In that scorched land, he didn't think it would take much. But he didn't have much. He had nothing. No one expected the Frey would have visited Purdiff first. Most villagers had braziers. Given the trouble and time that went into making fire, they just kept one going. Such a thing, he could see, was a luxury in Dorea. Not a tree visible for miles. There wasn't even much wood on the pile. Most of it looked to be sheep dung. How well could that burn? Persephone had likely ordered a mound of logs built last fall, but who could resist a giant pile of wood just up the hill from a village facing a cold winter? He hobbled toward the pile as best he could, which wasn't good at all without his crutch. Giving up, he crawled. Within the ambitiously wide circle of stones, only 3 logs and a few dried dung patties remained. This wasn't a signal fire. This was a large campfire.
Gifford lay on his back and let his body rest. His arms and legs ached, but he was alive.
He'd done the impossible. Gifford had broken out of Alanrist and raced across Dorea in less than a day on the back of a horse. But now what? He sat up. What would Roan do? She'd managed something ingenious, something that harnessed the power of the hot winds. Looking at the pile, Gifford didn't even see kindling.
I don't have so much as two sticks to rub together.
Crawling around, he found plenty of rocks.
Gifford had seen Herbert create sparks by striking two stones against each other, and he tried reproducing the process. None of the rocks he found worked.
I shouldn't have gotten off the horse.
He could have ridden farther. Perhaps there was another village nearby, one with a proper bow and kindling, or an eternal flame he could tap.
Searching around, Gifford realized he couldn't even see Narrowspur, who had wandered off.
How long does Alanrist have? How long does Roan? What a great hero I am, to come so far to fail because I can't—
Gifford focused on the little pile of logs and dung.
What was it Arion had said? Something about holding a sun-baked rock, and—
People who are creative are usually that way because they are more attuned to the power and forces of nature. They can hear the whispers of the world, and it helps guide them in the right direction.
Gifford stared at the pile. He had no hope of lighting it.
Unless— I want you to do me a favor, Gifford. I want you to move your hands like this.
He'd tried it many times since then, and it never worked. The attempts had always failed, but then he'd never needed it to succeed.
Have you ever wanted something to happen, and then it did?
Gifford had never wanted anything more in his life than to light that fire.
Imagine it. Imagine it turning black as ash.
He stared at the pile and took a breath. Raising his hands, he made the plucking motions.
Concentrate. Close your eyes if you need to.
He did. He closed his eyes and imagined the pile bursting into flame.
A loud woof, followed by a burst of heat, the crackle of wood and flame. Lots and lots of flames.
He opened his eyes.
Nothing.
The few logs and the heap of dung remained unchanged. It didn't even smoke.
She had lied.
He didn't know why, but she had. Her and the mystic had—
The armor! It's covered in runes!
Gifford threw off his helmet and, after finding the buckles, pulled off the rest of Roan's gift.
He concentrated once more. And as he focused, an idea pushed into his mind.
Clap your hands.
The thought came unbidden.
Was it a memory? Something the mystic had said?
Gifford wasn't sure. Maybe she had. He couldn't remember.
All he knew was that the thought had popped into his head, oddly clear, strangely certain.
Fear and excitement gripped him then, as he knew it would work.
The answer to the puzzle was provided, and as so often was the case, it was obvious. Oftentimes, we hear it as our own thoughts, telling us to go left, or just a sense that going right is a bad idea. Some might call it intuition, or a gut feeling.
But it is the world speaking in an ancient language that you can almost understand.
The warm wind blew hard across his face.
Roan would use the wind, he thought again.
Gifford scanned the horizon. He knelt in that desolation on the small knoll in the center of an endless plain. Rediscovering how to speak our native tongue, how to tap and use that power in meaningful ways, is what we call the art. He was alone. No one could see or hear him. He closed his eyes again, and this time he hummed. The wind came once more, a soft, fluttering kiss that moved his hair. He held up his hands and let the air move through his fingers. Nothing happened, nothing magical, except clay. Like the idea of clapping, this new thought came to him. He didn't know if it arrived from without or within. The effect, however, was powerful. Another puzzle piece fell into place, and he was starting to see the bigger picture. The air was clay. The way it felt passing between his fingers, the way it seeped and spewed. This was how he shaped his cups and pots and vases. This is how he created. Gifford's stomach fluttered in excitement. Something was there. Something that hadn't been before, something real. He was making a connection. This wasn't make-believe. This was a genuine thing. The Frey and the Mystic hadn't lied. He'd found something, and it was inside him. Clay. The wind, the air, the sun, the ground. It was all clay. And he could shape it. He reached out and felt the wind as a malleable thing. His fingers felt something else, something strong, warm, and deep. He drew it back, as he often did with the clay, squeezing, bending it to his will. Dirt and water spinning beneath his fingers became miracles of art. That's all he had to do. Make art. He formed fists and felt the heat build. The air swirled faster and faster, gusting his hair, pushing side to side, throwing up pebbles in a tiny storm. But when he opened his eyes, the pile was no different. There was no fire, no heat, no smoke.
Failure. Another in a long, long line.
Gifford's shoulders slumped. Only this time, this failure, he thought of Roan, of her dying, of being made a slave again, and didn't just cry. He sobbed hard and loud. What difference did the wailing anguish of a cripple matter to the world or to the gods? Clap. Gifford's hands were still bent in two tight fists of rage and sorrow. He hated himself, the world, the gods, the vultures, the village, and most especially that awful pile of dung he knelt before.
I love you, Woan.
He spoke the words as a prayer, with tears spilling down his cheeks. Then, with all his might, he spread his arms and slapped his palms together. The pile didn't catch fire. Most of Purduf exploded. Chapter 23 Inside the Kype. Some moments we see clearly. We know they are important. Births and deaths are just such times. Others sneak up on us. Invisible from the front, but always always obvious from behind. The Book of Bryn. The sun was setting when Wraith knocked on the door to the Kype. He wasn't alone this time. Moya and Malcolm stood with him as the little window in the door slid back. The same pair of eyes shifted, registering each face. The eyes didn't look happy.
"Open up, Paul," Moya ordered.
The eyes focused on Wraith.
You're gonna open that door, Moya told him, or I'll put an arrow through that skull of yours.
The eyes blinked. The window in the door shut, then the big bronze door opened. Porik was a surprisingly small Frey, with white blonde hair, who appeared to live in the nearby little room filled with dirty bowls, empty cups, and piles of wood shavings. 20 or 30 tiny animal carvings lined the shelves and tables. Porik watched Wraith enter with what looked like a mix of fear and anger.
"It will be fine," Malcolm reassured him. "Wraith has a broken arm. Makes it hard to properly strangle a person that way."
"Hard," Wraith said. "Not impossible."
Porik's eyes widened, and a hand fluttered to his throat. This might have made Wraith smile if he hadn't been in such a foul mood. He didn't have anything against Porik. The Frey was only doing his job. Apparently, someone had told him not to let the Durean in except for official meetings. Wraith had enlisted the help of Moya rather than Suri or Arion. Suri, who didn't appear to care for Nephron any more than he did, would have jumped at the chance for a little fun. But Wraith didn't want to cause that much trouble until he knew what was going on. Moya was the obvious choice. As S.H.I.E.L.D., no one could stop her from escorting him to the Koenig. If Nephron tried to, then Wraith might have a talk with Suri. Moya led the way up the stairs.
"Careful, the second one is crumbling. I usually just jump it."
Moya had denied any nefarious attempts on Nephron's part to keep Wraith and Persephone apart. But Moya also said she had no idea why the Koenig would refuse to see him. Under normal circumstances, he thought she would talk to Persephone before letting him in, but nothing was normal that day. The war had begun, Wraith was wounded, and Persephone had nearly died the night before. Time felt in short supply, and when Wraith had added, "How would you feel if you learned Tek-Chin was wounded, nearly died, and they wouldn't let you see him?" That was all it took. They climbed 8 flights to what Wraith realized was the top of the Kype. Just as sparse and cold as the rest of the fortress, the Kype made a poor home. While Alan Rist exhibited power and elegance, this building was colder and more barren than Durea. Despite the lack of food and the relentless winds, Wraith's people had songs, dances, and the laughter of children. The Kype was silent, their steps echoing.
"We have her in the shrine," Moya explained. "Used to be the private chambers of Alan Rist, the guy this place is named after. He was the only Fane from the Instaria tribe, so they sort of worship him. Ruled only for 5 years before dying in some fight. They kept his rooms exactly the way he left them."
She stopped and looked back.
"You might not want to touch things. The Frey get a little touchy about stuff like that."
"If I find they've treated her badly, I'll do more than touch things." They found familiar faces standing guard out in front of the chamber door. Grigor, Ares, and Tek-Chin all smiled at their approach. They were playing a game of stones. Tek-Chin had the biggest stack.
"I asked you to watch her door," Moya admonished Tek-Chin.
The Frey shrugged. I get bored easily. Not into wood carving like Porik. Left alone, I'd end up nibbling the ends of my fingers or something.
Any change would be an improvement, Grigor said.
Thanks. Moya expressed the one word with weight to all of them, then leaned in and kissed Tekchin. You're a lifesaver. Embarrassed, Tekchin turned to Wraith, pointed at his arm and said, Got a scratch, eh?
Had a disagreement with a giant, Wraith replied, glancing at Grigor, whose head nearly touched the high ceiling.
They're animals, Grigor said. Never trust one to keep a secret, or not to bite the head off a room just to make a point.
Ares and Tekchin nodded gravely, which made Wraith wonder, not for the first time, if the Galantians were joking. Moya opened the door, and Wraith walked inside alone. The shrine was a suite of rooms decorated with tapestries depicting battles and containing sculptures of half-naked Frey wielding spears or javelins, their muscles straining. Dark wood chairs with red cushioned seats and gold vases and candelabras filled the space with an aura of opulence. This was by far the greatest assembly of wealth Wraith had ever seen. To think such splendor existed across the river from the dung-brick home he was born in was shocking. Did any of the Doraeans ever have a clue? Did they even know such things were possible? If we win the war, how can we ever return to lives lived in dirt? What will become of us if we're victorious? What will happen to the world? And yet this room, too, while lavish, felt lifeless. Everything was so clean, so ordered. This wasn't a home to the living. It felt like a tomb, and he didn't like the idea that they had put Persephone up in such a place. He moved gingerly, creeping across carpets like an intruder. A door to another part of the suite opened, and Bryn came out. She smiled and pointed at him with a hairbrush that she was holding. You're in luck. She just woke up. Bryn gestured at the door. I'll wait outside. Wraith stood in the center of the shrine, watching Bryn leave, then looked back at the door. Why am I so nervous? It's just Persephone. He reached out for the latch and hesitated. For a moment, he thought to turn around, to just leave. Maybe this is a mistake. If Moya says she's okay, then she is. If she were in trouble, Bryn would have said something. Padera would have said something. Moya would have done something. They love Persephone, too. I'm being stupid. Wraith knew Nephron wasn't keeping Persephone a prisoner. He'd known it all along. He just didn't want to face the truth. He still didn't. Wraith turned away to leave. Wraith! He heard her call. Wraith! Too late. He opened the door slowly and poked his head in. Persephone lay on a huge canopy bed, adorned with thick embroidered blankets and pillows of shiny cloth. There was no window, and the only light came from three oil lamps that filled the air with a sooty stench. There were other smells, too, unpleasant and unknown. I thought I heard Bryn talking to someone. Bryn just left. Come in, she said. Persephone looked beautiful. Her face did, anyway. The rest of her was covered by quilts. Knowing that a row had attacked her, Wraith had been worried about what he'd find. As it turned out, she was pale, but other than that, she looked well. He moved in slowly, noting his surroundings. Several tables were littered with bowls and glasses, pestles and mortars. Jars were filled with different powders, the source of some of the smells. Wraith crept up until he stood at the edge of the bed.
"I heard about the attack. You all right?"
"I will be."
She made a clawing motion to her stomach. "Some pretty deep cuts make it just about impossible to move. So I'm stuck here while everyone else fights. I feel terrible about that. I'm supposed to be the Koenig, and sure, I didn't expect to be leading the attacks like Reglan did, but I thought I would be able to see them."
"I think your job was getting us here, giving us this chance. Now we have to succeed."
She focused on his arm, and her face wrinkled with sympathetic pain.
"Was it awful?"
"I guess that depends on who you talk to. According to everyone who watched, it was wonderful."
He frowned. "Farmer Whedon was killed. So was Kurt, Tope's youngest. And Hanson Killian." He saw the name's impact on her features and stopped himself.
"Several others, too. I just don't know their names," he lied. "But it could have been so much worse."
Filled with guilt at having falsely accused Nephron, he added, "I hate to say it, but Nephron's plan of putting those runes on the armor and having Moya's archers attack the Miralith was brilliant."
"Why do you hate to say it?"
He came closer, touched the covers on the bed with three outstretched fingers.
"Because he's my rival."
"Rival?
Isn't he?"
She didn't answer. Her eyes searched the bedspread for one.
"I had it in my head that the reason I wasn't allowed into the Kype to see you was because of him, that he had given orders to keep me away.
But he didn't, did he?"
"No, he didn't."
Persephone started to push herself up and cringed in pain.
"Easy," he told her.
She shook her head and made a dismissive wave as she struggled to breathe.
"I'm fine. I'm fine."
"You sure?"
"Yes."
The pain looked to have mostly subsided, and Persephone seemed more embarrassed than anything else.
"You were saying that you tried to see me?"
"Yes. I came almost every day at first. Then less so, as winter came on. Guess I started getting the hint. I was always told you were too busy. I believed it because I needed to."
She didn't say anything, refused to look at him.
"Do you love him?"
"It's complicated. He..."
The words struggled to come out. She smoothed the covers.
"He asked me to marry him."
Wraith didn't say anything after that. He couldn't. He was too frightened. When he was a boy, Dedan had once crept up behind him and put a dagger to his throat, whispering, "Don't move." That was how it felt, standing beside Persephone's bed. Those words lingering in the space between them, dropped, but not swept away. He waited. Waited for her to say that she had turned Nephron down. Waited for her to laugh at the very thought. She didn't. Persephone said nothing at all. And the moment lingered until finally Wraith couldn't bear it any longer.
"Have you slept with him?"
Her head jerked up.
"No, it's not like that." "Then how is it? I don't see how my personal life is your business."
The words hurt. She wouldn't have said that a year ago when Conniger wanted her dead. Back then she'd welcomed him into her world, begged him to stay, wanted him to be part of her personal life. Back then, when he had asked for her hand, she had said the memory of her dead husband made remarrying impossible. She must have seen the look on his face
and read part of it correctly. "Listen, Wraith. I'm the Keenig now. I have to think about what's best for the clans. And you're right. Nefren is brilliant."
"Why did I ever say that?"
"He's brilliant, all right. He's twisted you to his will. That's how brilliant he is. He's given us the chance to survive. He and I have united the runes and the Instaria. Together we can..."
"I'm too late, aren't I?"
The phrase, "he and I," was what did it. They were a team now. Wraith looked away, his sight drifting across the shiny sheets, across the big bed. Big enough for two.
Did he visit her, creeping in when it was dark? Or did Nefren live with her now? Did he sleep there every night?
Which side was his?
"I'm just saying that without Nefren we don't stand a chance. He knows how to fight them, and he keeps the Instaria from..."
"You've already decided. You're going to marry him."
She didn't answer.
"You are, aren't you?"
She looked away, refusing to meet his eyes.
"It's what will be best for everyone."
Even Dedan hadn't actually slit his throat.
"No, not a slit throat. A stab to the heart."
Wraith stood very still, feeling the pain slip in through his ribs. A fine spear thrust. Very fine indeed.
"I am too late. I just thought that she..."
He sucked in a breath.
"Persephone, did you ever love me?"
He saw her stiffen. Her hands were clasped on her lap, a pile of pillows behind her head. Brynn had likely propped her and brushed her hair to receive him, so she could look her best for the execution. Persephone did indeed have loyal friends. Moya had led him there, and Brynn had held the door.
"Wraith, this isn't about love. You have to be able to see that."
Her tone became concerned.
"If I were to refuse, if we were to lose Nefren's support..."
"You refused me. Did I leave? Did I turn against you?"
"He's not you, and it's not the same thing."
"How is it different?"
"You were being selfish.
You wanted me to run off to some mythical land of perpetual sunshine and a life without want.
You asked me to abandon my family.
Nefren wants to help save them."
"Selfish? You're calling me selfish? I gave that dream up. I stayed. Stayed when I knew I was a fool to do so. You say Nefren wants to save your people. But who volunteered to fight the Gula Keenig? And why did I do such a stupid thing? For me? No. But I can tell you this. That's exactly what Nefren is doing. He's the selfish one, not me. I didn't see him out there on that field."
His words were spiteful and bitter. He didn't want them to be, but he couldn't stop.
"I was the one who nearly died when a 10-foot giant hit three of us with a sledgehammer. The same one that killed Whedon. I was the one out there saving your family. Where was Nefren?"
"He can't..."
"He could! He just won't!"
Wraith's voice rose.
"I asked you to come with me because I didn't think we stood a chance fighting the fray, and because I know what war is like. I lived with men who made a profession of it. I've seen what it does to people, to those who fight year after year, and even more to those they leave behind. And maybe I was wrong about part of that. Maybe we can win. But I was right about the effects of war. And still I stayed. And I know one more thing. I know I love you. Nefren doesn't, but I do. And I thought...
I thought you loved me too!
She stared at him, a hard look on her face.
Stone! She looks like stone, cold and unmovable. A perfect Koenig. Did you? Do you?
No, she finally said. Silence followed. In a fight, it was possible to get used to the sound of the crash. The clang of metal on metal made a rhythm, a kind of music. Combat slipped into a duet, with each side playing their role until one attack slipped through a guard. Then the music stopped. Unexpected silence always followed, made loud by the expectation of the beat that never came. Wraith stood in that silence. His guard had been broken, her stroke pierced true. In her eyes, he saw the shock and fear, the regret he often spotted on the faces of the trainees when a move worked and they actually hit him.
Doesn't matter, Wraith said softly. Even that doesn't matter. Doesn't change the way I feel. Can't say I know much about it, but I know that's not how love works.
Persephone's hands gripped the covers. She opened her mouth, but he no longer wanted to hear what she had to say, and he wasn't done. She deserved to hear all of it, at least the Persephone he knew, or thought he knew, deserved it. That's how it felt. Not like she had rejected him, but like someone he loved had died. She had evidently died some time ago, but he was only now hearing the news. Not having been invited to the funeral, Wraith offered his eulogy.
I've loved you from the start. Maybe from the moment I first saw you in the forest. But certainly after you spoke to me like a real person, even though you knew I was Duraen. And it doesn't matter if you can't love me, whether it's because you're still in love with Reglan's memory, or because you want to marry Nefren. None of that matters, because... His voice cracked. Because even now... Even now...
His voice broke the way his father's sword had. He was left with the shattered, useless remains. Except Malcolm wasn't there this time. And he wasn't saved. Wraith spun away and headed for the door. He'd wanted to see her so badly for so long, but at that moment he wanted nothing more than to get away.
Wraith!
She called. But he didn't stop. He moved past the group waiting in the hall.
Why do there have to be so many witnesses?
Wraith, Bryn called. What happened?
He headed for the stairs, wiping tears from his eyes.
There's just no winning for some people. Doesn't matter if you do everything right. Once the gods hate you, there's no happiness that can be achieved. And hope is just another torture.
Chapter 24. Dawn's Early Light. I honestly do not know what happened that morning. Only one person alive did, and I never had the courage to ask her.
The Book of Bryn.
Want a lay? Want a lay?
He opened his eyes to find a dark world where a stretched canvas tarp quivered in the wind. Took a moment to remember where he was, in a tent on the edge of a barren battlefield. Depression filled him. He had been dreaming of Macaretta. He'd spotted her in a crowd on the streets in Estramnadon and had struggled to reach her, then woke up. That left him in the lonely dark, listening to the gusts and thinking about her again. No one knew what had happened to Margareta. Or maybe they did, and chose not to tell him. He thought it was possible that she was locked in the same cell where they had held Vidar. Or maybe they gave her to Vidar to make up for his wrongful imprisonment. As much as he hated Margareta for what she'd done, he thought he would kill the senior counselor if he'd hurt her. That's why he thought he might be in love with Margareta, and maybe that was also why everyone had lied to him about where she was. A gust of inexhaustible wind made his tent sing a dull note. I hope the stakes were driven in deep. Montalais was bundled up in a pile of wool blankets, topped by a bearskin. Only his head was exposed, and his nose felt numb. The sound of the wind made it worse. He couldn't actually feel it, but the howl spoke a rumor of bitter cold. Montalais, answer me. Montalais cringed. He'd thought it was fun to be able to listen in on Gerard's conversations, or to turn him on like a personal storyteller and let him play in his head while he rode. But having Gerard invade his mind uninvited, and in the dark hours of the morning, left him feeling violated. While he knew Gerard couldn't hear his thoughts, Wanderlei didn't feel safe, even in his own head. He considered not answering. He could even pretend to snore. He was thinking just how annoying that could be when Gerard spoke again. I know you can hear me. I know you're awake. I've listened to your breathing for hours, and I can tell the difference. I was sleeping, he said. Sleep tomorrow. We need to get to work. Wanderlei yawned, wiped his eyes, then began to moan. He moaned a lot, a dull, low tone that he was certain made dealing with life easier. What kind of work? He hoped it wouldn't be any more lessons. He was sick to death of them. At the academy, they made him do all kinds of repetitive tasks that made him wonder whether jumping off the Talwara balcony would really hurt so bad, or if he would just instantly die. We're going to kill Arion. Montalais's head came up off the pillow. How? The spiders tried that yesterday. They can't find her. She's hiding. She can't hide from Avampatha. Wanderlei pushed up, letting his covers slip, and swung his bare feet to the ground. Forgetting that the floor of his tent was the field, he flinched when he felt the brittle grass poking against his soles and tickling his bare legs. I thought the spiders and Casimir could handle it, but she's crafty. Should have guessed. Did you know Fenelius named her Senslaw? What do you want me to do? Wanderlei wiped his eyes and ran a hand over his bare scalp, cringing as he felt the stubble forming. He hated hair. Couldn't understand why Feral allowed it to grow on Miraleith. The more it grew, the dirtier he felt, as if the runic world was infecting him. This won't be without risk. You understand?
I don't care. I want her dead.
Good. Then I need you to go where you can see the fortress. Get away from the camp, away from others, especially away from other Miraleith. Get in a nice, lonely place, where you have a perfect view of the whole fortress, and then let me know.
Right now? It's the middle of the night.
It's almost morning. And yes, right now. I wanted to do this hours ago, but you sleep with the dedication of a depressed drunk. We need to do a search, and it'll be easier the quieter things are. Stillness makes hunting more efficient. So get up and—
Okay, okay. I'm moving. It's not like where you are, you know. I'm in an awful tent. It's dark. It's cold.
and there's a wind that doesn't stop blowing. You whine a lot. I suppose being the spoiled child of the Fane, people don't dare tell you that.
They should.
As I am indeed the son of the Fane, how is it you dare?
Because I know your father would side with me.
Treya, he called.
An instant later, his bleary-eyed servant stepped in, rubbing her face and blinking repeatedly.
Treya wasn't much to look at. Most of the time, Wanderlei didn't bother. She was an ever-present staple in his life, like his shoes or his goldfish. Always there, never noticed. But he couldn't recall having seen Treya fresh out of bed. She was always up much earlier than he. At least it seemed that way. This was the first time since he was a child that she appeared unkempt. Her hair, which was always hidden in a wrap on the top of her head, was down. He was surprised to discover she had light brown hair. He was surprised she had hair at all. This revelation did nothing to enhance her appeal. Not only did Wanderlei not find hair attractive on anyone, hers was an atrocious mess of tangles and jutted up in peculiar, inexplicable ways.
"My sandals and cloak. Get them, and pour water into the basin."
Just enough starlight pierced the canvas for Treya to find her way around.
"Shall I make a meal for you, my lord?"
Wanderlei shook his head. Too early. His stomach wasn't ready for food yet. With sandals and cloak already on, he paused to splash water on his face. It was icy cold, so he opted to just dip his fingers and wipe his eyes.
"Are you going out, my lord?"
Treya asked.
"Yes."
"Shall I come with you?"
Wanderlei hesitated, but shook his head. Best he did this alone, and he couldn't endure another minute near that hair. As much as he tried not to look at it, he'd catch sight of it out of the corner of his eye, bobbing and dipping like some ghastly puppet performing on her head. He pulled back the flap on his tent, as much to comply with Jared as to escape Treya. He'd had no idea how stuffy the interior of his tent was until the fresh air greeted him. Damp and chilled, the world outside was alive with crickets and peeping frogs. All around were other tents, and fires that had dwindled to glowing coals. Stepping outside, letting the tent flap fall behind him, Wanderlei didn't know where to go.
"Pits are that way, my prince."
The duty guard stationed outside pointed to the south.
"Ah, thanks."
Wanderlei didn't know why he said it, or why he turned and went south, or why he felt he had to be secretive. He wasn't doing anything wrong, but it felt that way. He was on a clandestine mission following the instructions of the voice in his head. Some might even call that insane.
"Look out! Look out for the mad prince!"
He slipped into the shadows and around to the south past two more guards, who just nodded respectfully. He picked his way, moving fast. Cold had a way of adding urgency to any endeavour. He passed the pits and kept going down the slope out beyond the pickets, then veered to the west, toward Alan Rist. In the starlight he could see fine, and he pinpointed an escarpment of rock rising from the plain. Looking a bit like a crooked finger as it jutted up and out, the crack appeared to have a small trail running up one side.
"Where are you? What are you doing?"
Jared pestered him.
"I'm having breakfast with a family of bears. Tarts with jam and cinnamon tea. Bears are very good cooks, you know."
"Don't get flippant. This is serious."
"I'm climbing a rock to get a good vantage point to see the fort. That's what you wanted, isn't it?"
"Are you outside the camp?"
"Yeah, about 200-300 yards, I guess."
"Good. Let me know when you've found a spot. A quiet spot."
The trail was precarious,
and Mandalay was regretting his decision to take it. Narrow, with a sheer drop on one side, and cliff wall on the other, he found himself shimmying along. By the time he reached the top, he was no longer cold. He was sweating.
"Okay, I'm at the top. Have a good view of Alan Rist."
Mandalay peered west. He was up only 60 feet, but it felt as if he could see forever. Below him, the entire Frey camp was visible, so that he could see the orderly precision of the tents, punctuated by the glowing red points of burned-out fires.
"Yeah, it's across this chasm. Bunch of walls, big dome, massive tower. Not so tall, now that they cut the top of it off."
"Okay, just sit down. Make yourself comfortable.
Keep your back straight, cross your legs, and just concentrate on Alan Rist.
Try not to let your mind wander. Just focus on the fortress."
"Okay."
"And try not to scream."
"Scream? Why would I—"
Mandalay jerked as he felt a jolt of power slam into him. He didn't scream. He couldn't. All he was able to utter was a weak squeak as his mind and body were blasted with the indomitable force of the Tower of Avampatha. Power flooded him so that he felt he might drown. Every muscle contracted, as if someone had dumped a barrel of ice water over his head. He managed a weak gasp as the fortress rushed at him. It grew rapidly larger, as if he were flying at it, or it at him. In an instant, he was viewing the great bronze doors. They were close enough to touch. Then he flew through them. A moment later he was standing in a courtyard where soldiers, both Rune and Frey, stood or walked. Not needing to use the stairs, Mandalay flew upward to a higher courtyard, and passed through barracks where men were waking up, getting dressed, and eating at long tables or with bowls in their laps. Passing through these, he reached the dome and rose to a balcony overlooking a huge round room filled with decorative weapons. He'd been in that room before, when he and Grindel had visited. Then he was whisked away, flying across a bridge toward a sturdy square tower built just in front of the decapitated Spyrock. This was the Kype, the fortress inside the fortress. Lamps were being lit. People were dressing. The fort was waking up, and Mandalay felt himself growing dizzy. He flew again, back this time toward the front of the Rist. The jerking, haphazard motion was making his stomach queasy as he flew through the many rooms and hallways, spinning left and right, searching for— He stopped. Suri handed the steaming tea over to Arion. The two were at the top of the frozen tower. With the Spyrock gone, it was the closest Suri could come to the out-of-doors. The nearest she could get to feeling any kind of freedom. She'd always hated walls, and lately she had been confined behind a great many of them. Although no one could actually stop her, Arion could put up a good fight, but Suri didn't even think she could do anything if Suri really wanted to go out. She had learned there were few things she couldn't do if she really wanted to. For the last month, her education with Arion had dwindled to discovering not what she could do, or how to do it, but the few things she couldn't. Flying was one, so was bringing back the dead, at least once they had crossed into that light, into the realm of pyre. Another was pure creation, making something from nothing. These were all beyond the art. Well, sort of. Nothing was really beyond it. The art was everything, the common thread that ran through existence, holding it together. Everything was part of the art. But some things, like pure creation and raising the dead, were so complex, so deep, no Frey or Rune artist
was likely able to master the weaves or control the power needed.
That was the realm of gods.